Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Don't ask reporters in Hawaii about the fucking tree. Because we still have a pretty big list of missing people. We're still counting dead bodies. The water system is messed up, and we have all this mess to deal with that. I don't know. We can include this. We cannot. It's just,
oh, I'm including it now. I'm going to put it up at the top. We're going to do it old. We're going to do it old school. I'm going to put it up. Yeah. I'm going to put this separate up at the top. And then
the title of this is just going to be Fuck That Tree.
Fuck That Tree. And then the intro music. And then we'll get into the real episode. People will love it.
One day, all of the facts in about 30 years' time will be published.
When genocide has been carried out in this country almost with impunity, and when it is near to completion, people talk about intervention.
You don't get freedom peacefully. Freedom is never safeguarded peacefully. Anyone who is depriving you of freedom isn't deserving of a peaceful approach.
Hey there, Angry Planet listeners. Matthew here. Jason is out today, but I'm here with Kevin Nodell, our mysterious and often in the background producer. He is a reporter for the Honolulu Star Advertiser, and he just got back from Maui, where he was reporting on the wildfires there. But kind of as a way to get into why we think that's an important thing to talk about on Angry Planet, and how Kevin, who is a military reporter, came to be reporting on it and covering it. Kevin, can you tell us, first of all, how are you doing today?
Tired. I think it's a misnomer to say that I just got back from Maui. That was now almost 2.5 weeks ago that I was on the ground there, but still fresh in my mind. I'm doing okay. Just got back from a wedding. Been in Pacific Northwest for the first time in 3 years. It's very smoky out here still, though, because of wildfires, which we may get into also. I have not seen Mount Rainier the entire time that I've been here, despite a cloudless day when I was looking in its direction.
So you can't escape the fires, essentially.
No. And we'll talk about that. I've covered, the military and conflict quite a bit, but fire has been a recurring theme throughout my career, writing in several places, but I'm sure we'll get to that in short order.
So you were supposed to go on vacation when? It was like the beginning of August, right?
Right. I was supposed to go to California for a week, where I was going to be working on a story there / kind of working remotely before I went on vacation, like real vacation, for 2 weeks immediately following. And it was just a situation where there was something connected to a story that I was already working on happening down in California right before I was set to go on vacation. And I asked my editors, hey, since this is happening, would you object to me just leaving, working remote, and doing that? Because it would just make travel a lot easier. It just lines up perfectly. But it ended up not working out, lining up as perfectly as I thought it would.
And why was that?
Well, on the night of August 8th, Tuesday night, I was very much off work, off the clock at that point. And I hadn't been following news on Maui. I think I had maybe heard something about some flare-ups of wildfires. But later that night, I get a call from my editor saying, hey, Lahaina is on fire. Like, the town is currently burning down as we speak. And we may need to send you over to Maui pretty shortly. And the next day it was decided, you know, the next day we're waking up to just this horrible news of the entire town having burned down, then quickly. And, you know, I'm looking at my phone and seeing all the videos of what had happened. And it was quite a shock to, I was bracing myself because I had heard about it, the night before, very late, but seeing it was, completely different. And, within the next day, I was on the ground, reporting.
Why are you the one that they called? What is it in your background that makes this something that you'd have the right perspective and experience to cover?
I'm not 100% sure. I think it is because I have, you know, crisis experience, and this was a crisis situation. I think it's also because I'm one of the younger staffers. And you know, it's easier for me to go. I don't have kids. I don't have stuff like that in the way. And, you know, I think that's kind of why they picked me. They never told me why me.
Okay, but you've also covered this topic extensively in other contexts, right?
I have. I guess I have covered wildfire quite a bit. Just not so much in Hawaii at that point. And other of my colleagues have also covered wildfire. Somebody had to go, and they picked me. I don't want to give myself too much credit on either of that. And I also don't know how much my editors were thinking about that. It was very much about like just getting out there and covering as much ground as we could.
But your perspective is interesting here. Something that you had told me earlier, let me see if I can get the quote exactly right, is that wildfires are the natural disaster that most resembles war. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, absolutely. I've thought about that a lot since, covering, I think 2015 was the first wildfire I would have covered. That was for War Is Boring. Back in the day, spent some time out there with in Okanagan, Washington, covering what was at that point the largest wildfire in Washington state history. I think I've got the year right on that. We've had several more largest wildfires in Washington state history since then.
Yeah, and, I think it was America's at War with Fire is the title of the article. Yeah, you were hanging out with the Forestry Service and some other people outside or is this a different?
I think that's the same year. So I think that was the article before I went out into the field.
Gotcha.
I think that was the overview of everything that was going on, because they also called up active duty, and like it was a big thing. But it feels like a footnote now, given other things that have happened. But to bring it back to, it is the thing that most resembles war. You know, most other natural disasters, they just kind of sweep through and that's it. Wildfires are different because wildfires can continue to burn, and they move. They don't stay in one place as they're doing that. Not that hurricanes do either, but you're actively trying to fight it, because you can't fight a hurricane. You can fight a fire. You can redirect it, and there's a front line. You know, you're moving resources. We now often use aircraft to fight fires. So you have your air crews, you have your ground crews. You're trying to manage your resources, move it around, and contain it or redirect it so it doesn't hit critical infrastructure or population centers. And a hurricane will come through, and you know, it'll come and go. You can be battling one wildfire for days, weeks, or even months, depending on its scale and depending on if it spreads or breaks apart. It's where you actually battle it. That's why we call it firefighting.
And the damage it causes is similar to what a war does, right? Or like a prolonged, or at least like a bombing campaign, or were someone to burn down a city.
Yeah, I couldn't help but think about that when when I actually saw Lahaina in person. It was difficult getting out there because there were lots of roadblocks, and they really, really were not letting people in. They really didn't want people to come in, and they were not really jazzed about journalists getting in there either. A few people were able to sneak into the town, like Lahaina Town Center itself, early on and get past the roadblocks. Me and the photographer I was working with, we didn't get into the city center, but what we did instead to get through the roadblocks is we hitched a ride with one of the aid convoys that was going through the town, not down to Front Street necessarily, but making our way to the Ritz-Carlton, where they were kind of collecting aid and redistributing it to people who had lost their homes or anybody else who was struggling. Because even if your home miraculously survived, you didn't have electricity. And within a few days, we found out also the water system was pretty much melted and contaminated and is unusable there. And also in Maui's upcountry happened. We'll get to this, but there were three fires simultaneously going on the island when this whole thing started.
Why didn't they want journalists in?
They just don't want, they didn't want a lot of cameras around. Also, you know, there were bodies in there. There was death. We still don't really know entirely the scale that they're still searching the wreckage.
It's like there's around 400 missing, presumed, right?
I think it's below that. Last I saw, it was somewhere more like 340, which is thankfully down from the 1,000. It was kind of before that. So it'll be, I don't know what the final death toll is going to be. Early on when I was on the ground, the official death toll was 36 confirmed, but the numbers that I was hearing from people were closer to 200 plus. I'm sure we can look up right now what the current one is as of this recording.
North of 100 as of this recording, I believe. Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely north of 100. I think the last I saw was 115. I'm on vacation right now, but also trying to follow it to the degree that I can before I get back to work next week.
So can you tell me about like what your immediate impressions were, what you saw, what you were thinking and feeling as you entered the town?
Yeah. I'd been to Lahaina before. Just a little bit of background on the town itself. It's a very old city. We don't have a lot of remaining towns in Hawaii that have that kind of old Hawaii architecture. I mean, you can also argue about like how old it is, because a lot of it is kind of from the whaling era and the plantation era. So it's very westernized, or was very westernized, but it's old. It's wooden architecture. It's not Waikiki. It's not big towering condos. I mean, there's big towering resorts, but most of that's north of the town and is out of town by design, so that people can go in and enjoy the cute little touristy town. There was some reporting early on from national and international media. I think it's improved, but talking about how this popular resort town burned down. But Lahaina is not merely a resort town. One, because lots of local people live there, but it used to be the capital of the Hawaiian Kingdom. It was where the whaling industry was based. It became a major agricultural hub. It's kind of the entire history of Hawaii you can kind of look at in one place and how it's changed. The only thing it's missing is a major military installation. That's kind of the only thing it doesn't have, but it's just got this really unique history and this unique blend of stuff. And as I was coming down the hill looking at it, and I'd kind of seen a few pictures, but it was just really striking to see how gone it was. It was just husks of ash. Like there were a handful of buildings that had survived, and even or partially, but most of it was just flattened, absolutely burnt to a crisp. I covered, you know, wildfires before, but this reminded me much more of like going through Syria, going through towns that had been destroyed during the ISIS campaign. Though I would even say, not to downplay what the suffering of the people of Mosul or Raqqa, but Mosul is still there. You know, I saw they've rebuilt quite a bit of it. You know, it's still early. We'll see what the rebuilding process in Lahaina looks like, but the destruction in terms of the physical destruction of this town was just very hard to fathom and very hard for me to communicate with words. People would call it a war zone. And, you know, that's something that, you know, I hate that comparison when we compare things that aren't war to war. Wholly appropriate to describe this place as looking like a war zone, because I can't think of anything else to compare it to.
Yeah, you'd sent some pictures to the group chat. I think they were taken by with your phone, just from like the, was it like out of the side of a car as you guys were going down the road?
So, one out of a car, and then one out of the truck as we were going back after the aid had been delivered.
Just nothingness. It was kind of wild that this fire just completely swallowed up this entire town. How do you fight a fire like this? What is the mechanism by which you do that?
So, all right, there's still some debate about what all went wrong. We'll get into that. Right now, there were some unique circumstances. I won't say that nobody could have seen any of this coming, because there were. This isn't the first time.
I was going to say there's been more wildfires in the area in the past few years, right? In
general, right, and also and Lahaina had actually been specifically noted by emergency planners at being at very high risk of exactly this happening. This had been discussed as something that needed to be looked at. But just kind of a play by play of how this went down, because I think that's helpful. This started as Hurricane Dora was moving south of Hawaii. You know, we're in the Pacific. We don't get hit by hurricanes very much. The last major one that hit was Hurricane Iniki, which did quite a bit of damage. But, you know, usually during this time of year, we get high alert. But, you know, a lot of times they just kind of slingshot around us, and we watch and they miss, because we're that as an island chain, we're kind of a small target, honestly, for hurricanes. But when Hurricane Dora went south, we didn't get hit by the rain or the storm itself, but we got the wind. So we had this very, very strong wind just kind of howling through the islands. I remember being woken up by it, like very, very early in the morning, like in the pitch black, and just hearing, you know, I could hear all the trees around where I live kind of like swinging around, and, you know, it was very intense wind. Now, what that meant on Maui, and that now there's going to be some lawsuits, and we're going to find out what really happened here. But on Maui, where there'd been drought conditions, and there've been drought conditions throughout the island, I believe it was 6:45 a.m. it was reported that a fire had kind of broken out around Lahaina, pretty kind of, you know, nearby on one of the roads. I think it was Lahaina Luna Road. But they respond to that fire, and there's a few fires going on the island because of these very dry conditions. And it's been very much widely cited that that downed power lines probably played a role in a lot of this. And we'll get into that in a second because there's going to be a interesting aftermath as in a lot of finger pointing as to what really happened. But by about 9 a.m., Maui Fire Department declares the Lahaina wildfire to be 100% contained at that point. And then as a result of that, you know, they didn't say that it was out. They said it was contained, though in their announcement that it was put out, they warned that the high winds that they were experiencing were still going to be a danger and that people should still be vigilant. But since they felt that that fire had been contained, they started moving more resources to the upcountry fire, which was a larger fire at that point. I think it should be understood. It's up in the hills. It's harder to get resources up there. A lot of logistics to make that happen. And one of the challenges that they were also having is because the hurricane was still passing through and the wind was still very high, they weren't able to use helicopters and weren't able to use their air assets. So firefighters were fighting these fires only on the ground, and they were doing it in these very dry conditions with high wind that was making the fire move faster than it would normally move. Just kind of this incredible mixture of circumstances that make this more difficult than a fire would usually be to fight. Throughout the morning, they're fighting for hours, really focusing on the upcountry fire, and then they kind of start telling people in the area that they should really think about getting out of the area if they have the ability to move. I think it was about 3:40 p.m. They say the Lahaina fire escaped containment and started moving toward Lahaina again, with again these very high winds. These very dry conditions, and they start trying to kind of recollect. We now have accounts of firefighters who are trying to battle the fire and their hydrants going dry, of them running out of water. We know that a lot of the pipes, because of the heat and because of various things and damage throughout the town as it spread, the water system is lost pressure, and a lot of the water is now, the water is considered contaminated. It's not considered clean. So nobody is drinking with it, and they've told people not to bathe with it until they can figure out how to fix all of that. The fire just kind of spread. It just continued to, it went into the town. And like I said, it's this old town. It's not so much like the other ones. So much of it is made of wood, and it's kind of packed together. Like think of kind of like an old West town, like kind of like Deadwood, but you know, with much more colorful painted, you know, right, facades. But we're talking like stuff that's been retrofitted and upgraded over the years. Some of this stuff is really, really old, and you know, old, beautiful wooden buildings. But now that a fire is coming through, it's exactly the conditions that helps something like this spread. But as it collects fire, it gets hot enough and it's moving fast enough that it's also melting steel. Concrete buildings are starting to collapse around the heat. It's this incredible literal firestorm that is just moving through the town. And people start trying to flee. You can see, I'm sure by now people have seen the pictures of the cars on the road that were just scorched. People abandoned their cars. Some people were not able to abandon the cars. We've found bodies in some of those cars. That's kind of my summary of what happened. There's more specific things about the response that we can get into, but that's kind of how the fires spread. And also, I want to stress too that in the following days, the upcountry fire was still a fire that they had to fight. I've seen some criticism that, you know, they devoted too much resources to the upcountry fire when Lahaina was the real danger. We'll see what happens, you know, in these investigations, but the upcountry fire was still a fire when I was there, and it has continued to be an issue, and flare-ups have continued to be an issue. And there was recently another evacuation even this week from another area because of another fire. These dry conditions are, this is not a thing that happened. This is a thing that is happening.
Like 3:42, they closed that road down between the highway and the bypass. And then, but 2 hours later, we have video of Main Street burning down, or the front, like
the
front street burning down. And, like 30 minutes after that, people fleeing the town into the ocean itself, trying to get away from the fire.
Right. I didn't. Yeah. A lot of people did seek shelter in the ocean. Coast Guard and other various vessels have picked them up. It's been kind of a debate right now about how many people may or may not have died in the ocean. There just aren't really good numbers. I talked to people who swear they saw bodies floating. There are a lot of officials who say, you know, like, no, there were not a lot of dead people in the water. I don't really know what to make of that right now, but I want to acknowledge that both of those things are positions that people have taken.
So what is now that we kind of know like a timeline of events for the immediate fire, like what does it look like to battle this thing? Didn't sound like it was going super well. Obviously there's a lot of infrastructure problems, contributing to this. Do we want to talk about that first? Actually, can you tell me about like downed power lines and a complete loss of water on the island of Hawaii?
Yeah. Well, not the islands of Hawaii.
Sorry. Yeah.
That's okay. That's okay.
I'm sure you get that all the time.
Yeah, I do. No, we all get to learn a little bit more about the geography of the Hawaii Islands. This is good. We get to learn more. People should know. We're still understanding how some of this happened, but the Maui County has now launched a lawsuit against Hawaiian Electric, saying that this was caused by the downed power lines, and they have responded by saying they will be forced to go to court and prove that Maui County is actually the most responsible and that they are not. And we're going to see how that goes. We'll talk, I think, probably right now about how, you know, both there's going to be so much blame to go around. The head of the Maui Emergency Management Agency, Herman Ndaya, was kind of, you know, not visible for several days. And then he went at a press conference and they asked him why the alarm sirens weren't sounded. And if he has any regrets, and he said no, and he resigned the next day for health reasons. We'll see what people ultimately decide. That, you know, there's several investigations going on right now to see what they ultimately decide about Ndaya's decision there. His explanation, I'll say, is not the stupidest thing I've ever heard, but it certainly didn't go over well. Maui has a very comprehensive, you know, warning system. It is called the all hazard siren systems. So on the website, it says that it is for tsunamis, for hurricanes, for wildfires. Like, you know, it said that it is for all these sorts of things. But his explanation, and I do understand this because this is sort of true, that they're almost exclusively used for tsunamis, and all the public education is about tsunamis. And he said that if people had heard the siren, they would have responded as if there was a tsunami and they would have moved Mauka. So in Hawaiian, we use the words Makai and Mauka because sometimes north and south isn't as helpful. Makai means toward the sea and Mauka means toward the center of the island. The fire was coming from Mauka. So his argument is if people had heard sirens, they would have moved toward the fire. Now, the people who still say that it should have been sounded was most people didn't. So many people didn't get the cell phone notice. So many people didn't get anything. And also, if people had woken up, had they woken up, they would have seen the fire pretty. They would have known what was going on pretty quickly, and they would have figured it out, or they would have gone on the street and people would have told them where to go. Because one of the problems is as it moved into the town at night, there were people who were asleep, and were woken up to the sounds or to the smell by the smell of smoke. they just had no idea what had been going on. So a lot of systems clearly failed. I'm not in a position to say whose fault it is, because I'm A, not a commentator. But I also really just don't know right now. There's so much here. Clearly, a lot of things went wrong. One thing I will say about the down power lines. So what I saw most recently is that Hawaiian Electric is saying they're admitting that the fire that morning was caused by a down fire, like a down power line. But they're saying that the fire that destroyed Lahaina was actually not even that fire, and was perhaps a completely different fire that was started in a completely different way. I'm very curious to see the documentation on that. Could be. I don't know. But what I'll tell you what I do know, and what I did see when I went up country. I saw a downed power line, you know, and I saw all the wires tangled in the branches. And I also saw a section of power line next to a downed pole where it was entangled with a bunch of burnt branches, and it looked like the wire itself had been charred. I'm not an expert, but if you were to ask me, I would say that was probably the point of origin of that particular fire. Stress that I don't know that for a fact. We'll learn more. But what I do know also is I talked to neighbors, and they heard a loud crash, then saw smoke, then saw fire. I can't say for sure what all that means, but I can suggest what I think it means. And I've got pictures of it, and people can judge for themselves. But I would also urge people to wait for the formal investigation of all this to be concluded, because, you know, this is my educated observation, but not a formal conclusion.
Is there a rush to assign blame right now?
Absolutely. You know, always is.
You're dancing around this so carefully, like you don't want to contribute a horrible problem.
Right. No. Well, I mean, I got to be careful. You know, I'm a reporter. I've got my own take on things, but truly, I don't know what to make of some of the things. Like another thing that happened, and I think this is instructive for kind of how things have gone, and also how things may go in this conversation as it moves forward, is the West Maui Land Company sent a letter to the state saying that one of the water managers stopped them from being able to divert water as the flames were coming. What kind of supposedly happened was that he told them, you know, you need to get permission from the upstream users, which was, I think it was from a taro, like a native Hawaiian owned taro farm upstream. Now this comes into some really thorny things about the history of Hawaii. Here.
Forgive my ignorance. What's taro?
Taro is kind of, it's like a potato, but it's not a potato. It's something that's been grown in Hawaii for a long time.
A lovely native yam.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crushed up sometimes to make poi, which I'm not sure how best to describe that. It's a very Hawaii thing anyway. And they're grown in, these kind of watery, not quite like a patty, but you know, just envision just kind of a nice, like, watery little farm. They're pleasant places to visit. It's nice. And, you know, and you can make really good hash browns out of taro. That's what I like making with it. But you can make all manner of things from taro. I'm very pro taro personally.
Sorry, is it like,
oh, sure.
Compared to sweet potato, is it like similar to sweet potato? Like, what are we talking here?
No, its texture is a lot harder.
Okay, so like, more like a normal, like more like a typical russet potato,
but like firmer than a potato,
even firmer than a potato. Okay,
yeah, I'm comparing it because it's definitely in the same like category of but it doesn't it's okay. We could spend a long time. So, look up tarot farming. It's an interesting thing, and there's a lot of interesting things about in Hawaii. But what I was bringing it to, because this is kind of where that becomes an issue, is this issue of water rights and who gets to control the water. Because this goes back to, you know, that was a traditional crop, but the sugar plantations ended up taking a lot of the water away from taro farmers and away from that sort of thing to really focus irrigation on their crops. Private land, because the Maui Land Company, you know, it manages a lot of water resources for people, but it's a private entity. It's not a public utility. So there's a lot of thorny history here about that. And there have been some new measures passed about making sure that people don't just get water redirected from them whenever people want. So, you know, they write this letter saying that this happened, and they by name mention, you know, the guy who they think is responsible. The guy has been reassigned by the state. He hasn't been fired, but he's been reassigned. And now there's actually a lawsuit to have him reinstated at that position. Groups like the Sierra Club and some of the other environmental groups and Native Hawaiian groups have said, you know, this seems like the Maui Land Company is exploiting a tragedy to blame this guy for, you know, a lack of water because they don't like the new water policies. And it seems like they're trying to blame these water policies on the fire when that's not necessarily what happened. Because I don't believe that company actually manages the water that would have gone in and out of the hydrants. That was kind of one of the things like, oh, well, you know, there wasn't enough water available. It sounds more like what happened is, you know, the pipes. Now, I say it sounds more like that. We don't know. You know, I have to caveat a lot of this stuff. We're going to continue learning more. And I don't take a position on who was on the right or wrong here, because I don't think there's enough information. I don't know. West Maui Land Company is going to make their case. The state's going to make their case. The people who have made the lawsuit to reinstate that guy are going to make their case. We're going to learn more stuff.
There's a lot of bureaucratic mess that goes with all of this.
Right. But I bring that up to illustrate that, but also to illustrate the historical baggage that's here, because that is a big thing. So something that we can say, and this is something that I can say with confidence, is that a big problem that was part of this is the invasive grass that is a byproduct of the sugar plantations that came to dominate, you know, the islands and reshape what they look like. Because Maui, In Lahaina in particular, used to have this used to be a wetland. You know, these were wetlands, and that's also why taro was very popular out there, because, you know, people used the water, people used the land, but it looks very different than it did all those years ago. And if anybody doubts this, like, you know, you can read, like, first of all, there's the oral history of the Hawaiian people who tell you what it looks like, but you can read the early contact, you know, like Captain Vancouver, what the Brits saw, like British Royal Navy, when they first came there, they saw it and they wrote about it, and they wrote about Lahaina as having, like, being lush, being watery, and being this very green, very full of water area. They did not describe it as brushlands that would have easily caught fire necessarily.
Right. It's guinea grass, I think, is one of the things that's being blamed. One of the many things that's being blamed, which is like African Yemen, pretty dry grass that easily catches fire. Mm-hmm. It's in my limited understanding. Okay. So that's kind of, I think that's good background for like the politics and the actual fire itself. What do you do in this situation if you are a firefighter and you have no water, or you have limited water, or complete lack of water pressure, and this thing is spreading around? Like, what do you do to fight this?
At a certain point, you have to cut your losses and flee, which is what a lot of them were in Lahaina, at least, they were forced to do once they found out that they didn't have it. They also lost some fire engines in the fire. You know, a lot of the firefighters that were there, they were from the Lahaina, you know, engine. A lot of them lost their homes too. They were. Nobody should suggest that they were not invested in putting out that fire, because they were, the guys on the ground were 100% invested in fighting that fire, and they had everything to lose, just like everyone else. And a lot of them have. They've lost the same things. And it's been, you know, I didn't talk to many of the firefighters, but some of my colleagues in broadcast media, we've also colleagues at the paper, we've written about people, lots of coverage in Hawaii media about what it was like to fight those fires from the firefighters. But, you know, you can tell it's emotionally difficult for them, not only to have lost that, but to have not been able to fight it, to have pointed the hose at it and had nothing come out, and to just be completely powerless in the face of something so massive. Well, one thing I will say, this wasn't from a firefighter. This was one of the people who escaped told Cindy, the photographer that I was working with on the ground, that, you know, as he was fleeing, that not only the heat, but the sound of this massive fire, he said that it was like running from a dragon.
Jesus. All right, Angry Planet listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
All right, Angry Planet listeners, welcome back. We are on with Kevin O'Dell. All right, so kind of as you teased the beginning of this conversation, you're in the Pacific Northwest, you're on vacation, but you have not escaped wildfires. The smoke from one of them is wafting in, making your life very lovely. Sure seems like there's been a lot of fires lately, Kevin.
Yeah, and why ever would that be? It's like I said earlier, it's been something I've worked on a bunch. It wasn't necessarily something I sought, but it's found me. Whether it be covering various military bases or in Iraq and Syria, and it's out there was a little bit sometimes ambiguous whether it was a wildfire or whether it was a fire set by ISIS. ISIS took credit for some of that, so I think there was intentional burning of crops. There was that sort of stuff. But I think, and, you know, this is where we get into the thing that becomes so politically charged, unfortunately. You know, whether it's there, whether it's anywhere else, the common thread in a lot of these places, whether there's invasive species or not, is more drought, more heat, and less water. You know, it's. This is a thing that we're seeing in a lot of places. There's wildfires right now in Louisiana. There's wildfires across Europe. Obviously, up in Canada, that's where a lot of the smoke I'm getting right now is from. But also some smoke I was told from Spokane. I haven't been following all the wildfires. It's hard to keep track of all of these. It's becoming, you know, a bigger issue. It's ubiquitous. They're a part of our life now. I mean, they've always been kind of growing up in the American West, that it was always something that was there, but it's not, it's different than it was.
How is it different than it was? Is it more frequent, more intense?
both. You know, fire is, and yeah, you have to remember that, you know, fire is a phenomenon. It's in its own way kind of natural. Prairies, the western forests, lightning strikes can start a fire. Throughout the history of this, of the region that I'm in right now, you know, like Hawaii, a little bit different, though I don't think that we can say that there's never anything natural out there. You know, fire is just a thing that exists. Fire is neither good nor bad. It is not evil. It doesn't have any, it is not malicious. Even though I compared it to war because it moves and it is more like any other natural disaster, like a war. You have an enemy, but it is not a malicious thing. It does not seek to destroy anything in particular. I think something, every summer when I was growing up, my family used to go to the Wallowa Mountains in eastern Oregon, and we would pass by a mountain range called the Blue Mountains. And I actually looked this up to confirm whether this is true. I can't confirm one way or the other, but, you know, oral history is funny this way. So I'm just going to tell people this with the caveat that maybe this isn't true. But I was always told that this was true. I was told that they were called the Blue Mountains because smoke made them look blue, and that's what the indigenous people called them, that smoke from around the area. And I've been thinking about this because eastern Oregon, anytime I went out there, the air was always just a little bit smoky. And it was actually a smell that I came to associate with, you know, not bad memories necessarily. You know, you people would be barbecuing out there, or there would be bonfires or fire, or, you know, chimney smoke. You know, there was always just a little bit of smoke in the air, and controlled burns in some of the farms. You know, fire can be good for the soil. It revitalizes the soil. It adds nutrients. Fire is just part of the West. It's not inherently good or bad, but there's just a lot more smoke right now. A lot more fire. I think the Paradise Fire in California was a big wake up call. The 2018 fire that also burned down in a town, kind of similar to Lahaina, but, you know, it's Lahaina is now very much eclipsed it, though there are similar debates around that, because that one was caused by down fire lines and, you know, led to a massive lawsuit, which I think is something that Hawaiian Electric is really looking at. Everybody's really kind of looking to that fire to kind of look at what the aftermath of this one might look like. But, you know, like I said, there's also things about it that are not the same. There were no taro farms around there. So it's going to be different, and it's going to have its own Hawaii aspect to it. But fire is becoming a much more prevalent thing all around the world, and it's going to more and more disrupt our infrastructure and disrupt our lives.
One might say the climate is changing.
One might say that the climate is changing. There's a story I did back in 2019 that I've been kind of revisiting periodically, and especially have been thinking about after what I saw in Maui. I don't know if everybody remembers when the Trump administration at the time wanted to redirect a lot of defense funding to fund the border wall as part of an emergency move to block off the border. I was asked by Crosscut, which is a nonprofit news organization out in Seattle based out in Washington State, to look at programs that were on the cutting block out here. And I was looking at a few of them, you know, and various other reporters reported on what the projects were. But one that I looked out at the Yakima Training Center, and they had two. One was a vehicle maintenance facility that they were going to lose out on, and the other one was upgrades to their facilities fire department. And I end up calling calling the facility. And weirdly enough, I actually just got like the commander of the facility on the line, because I don't, it's a small facility. They didn't really have a lot of resources at the time. I didn't, when I asked for his name at the end of the conversation, he told me like, oh, I'm just the guy who runs the entire thing. But what he told me, you know, I asked, you know, if these were going to be problems for the base. And he said, yeah, especially the fire department. And I was expecting him to say the maintenance facility. And I said, okay, you know, why is that? And for people who are not familiar with the Yakima Training Center or the Yakima area, also kind of a dry, deserty area, but like a lot of brush, you know, and surrounded by a lot of ranches and that kind of thing. Soldiers who train there call it Yakistan. And it was, you know, a very, very well-used training area during the GWAT years, because it very much resembled the sorts of terrain that they would be going to. Looks a lot like Kandahar. But what the commander told me was, you know, we have perhaps more training-related fires than any other facility that the U.S. military has. That's what he said. I don't know if that's true, but I actually asked a few other people and they said, yeah, that sounds about right. Just because of what they have out there. And it was very important for them that they be able to put out fires. And also that their fire department be able to pitch in neighboring firefighters, you know, like firefighting resources get spread so thin and everybody needs to pitch in. They had actually had a massive fire on that had started on that range called the Range 12 fire. It was it started out as a result of training, and it spread and jumped the training area, jumped the highway, and started burning down actual farmland. And it led to the Army being sued to the tune of quite a bit by some of the neighboring ranchers and farmers. And that was a major concern for him, both because, you know, it's bad to have that sort of thing happen. You don't want to burn down your neighbor's stuff, that, you know, you don't want to burn critical farmland and infrastructure in the area. But yeah, he also said, you know, any time we even have like a spark, we really got to stop training here. And if we don't have the ability to stop that, you know, it disrupts military readiness, but also fires here. And whether it's training related or not, because there are non-training related things. It could be a lightning bolt. It could be just sometimes things just get really hot and things just burn. And he said, you know, we need that. We need to have the resources to be able to do that correctly. And if we don't, then this training area becomes borderline not usable for us. And the reason I bring that up is to bring up that, you know, this is stuff that is a national security issue. It really is, or a global security issue, really, because this is happening all around the globe. You know, I think when we talk about climate stuff and historically when we've talked about this or talked about pollution or talked about issues like this, you know, it's always been, you know, like save the whales, which doesn't resonate for a lot of people because they don't see whales that often. They're just not attached. Like, oh, save the polar bears. They're cute and that upset people for a while, but then they kind of lose track of that. Save this random bird somewhere that I've never heard of and don't care about. You know, that's so much of what drives these conversations. But I think what we're starting to see now is that it's not just coming for that stuff. It you know, it starts with burning down the forests that people have wanted to hike in. And, you know, that's very sad. But then it's starting to come for the farms that grow our food. And now it's burning down the towns, people's homes and the people in them. They're coming for the places and the people that we love, not just for animals or stuff like that. It's starting to really, really come here now. One thing that was really interesting to me about actually the response, so many people, one of their first questions was like, is the banyan tree okay? And for people who don't know, so like there's a very large, very beautiful big tree in Lahaina. I'm not even going to say was, because it might actually, it was outwardly charred, you know, blackened, but there's signs that it might actually still be alive. And I don't want to discount this entirely, because, you know, we've done some local coverage of it. And, you know, there are some people who had said, like, you know, this would be, if it's alive, it would be a powerful symbol for this town if it is able to be rebuilt. That being said, if you're listening to this, and if you're somebody who listened and you asked me about it, I'm not mad at you individually, but don't ask me about the fucking tree. Don't ask reporters in Hawaii about the fucking tree. Because we still have a pretty big list of missing people. We're still counting dead bodies. The water system is messed up, and we have all this mess to deal with. It's a lot less important than this tree, which I have to also point out is not a native tree. You know, it was planted. It's part of like the whole settler experience. You know, I mean, I'm a settler too, whatever. I'm not anti all of that. You know, there's a lot of history that was lost, you know, like this, but we really need to be thinking about people right now, and also about like repairing the land itself. Not this one tree. And it is genuinely been shocking to me how people just seem to have blurted out that particular one thing. And like, that was an area of concern.
It's the one thing they know it's one thing they know about the place, right? Like that's,
I guess, which is weird. Cause like I've been to Lahaina, and like that was not one of the things that stuck out to me. I mean, I guess I kind of remember it, but like that just was not that big of a thing. We have lots of banyan trees on also on Hawaii Island, and a bunch of them on Oahu. And there's some banyan trees near where I live. They're also big and impressive too. You know, that's just kind of my thought on this. You know, I'm not going to go so far as to say fuck the tree. I mean, I think I already did say that earlier.
You did.
On,
you did basically.
I did say that. I hope the tree is okay, and I hope that it lives. I do. But it is not top of mind of concerns, and for a lot of people on Maui, it is definitely not a top concern. There's some arborists out there, like there are some local people from the area who are monitoring it. You know, some people out there who are attached to the tree, but even I think they would say that, like, you know, they're doing that because that's a specialty of theirs. I think they would not think that that's one of the top priorities in terms of Lahaina's future, or like figuring out what happened. The tree is low on the priority. That I don't know. We can include this. We cannot. It's just.
Oh, I'm including it now. Thing. I'm going to put it up at the top. We're going to do it old school. I'm going to put it up. Yeah. I'm going to put this separate up at the top. And then
the title of this is just going to be fuck that tree.
Fuck that tree. And then the intro music. And then we'll get into the real episode. People will love it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They'll make me very popular. Yeah, everybody. Don't waste water. Be mindful where you throw your cigarettes. Don't start fires. We've got enough of them.
Kevin Nodell, thank you so much for coming on.
Glad to be here, I guess.
That's all for this week, Angry Planet listeners. As always, Angry Planet is me, Matthew Galt, Jason Fields, and Kevin Nodell. It's created by myself and Jason Fields. Thank you to the subscribers who go to angryplanetpod.com or angryplanet.substack.com and kick us $9 a month to keep us going. I know August was a little bit light. It's a little bit hard to get guests in August because everyone's on vacation. We are gearing back up into the normal swing of things here. Have some great episodes planned, some other special stuff coming for you. Again, at angryplanetpod.com or angryplanet.substack.com. $9 a month gets you commercial-free versions of all the mainline episodes and bonus episodes. We will be back next week with another conversation about conflict on an Angry Planet. Stay safe until then.
Here's a cool fact. a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.